But I don't know if Brian knew what that was or caught on, I guess.
Yeah, again, his name isn't Brian, it's third guy.
Third guy.
Newspaper guy.
I'm main guy. When a king is a whore, complying and warm. Miles outside in the eye of the storm. With a sight for the lore, and a prize and award. While avoiding the violent bazaar that is violence and war. True blue triumph is more like weight. Let it snake up under the centerfold. Let it break the walls of Jericho. Ready, go. Set where the old carport city folk. Swap tails with heads like every other penny. And I will remember your name and face on the day you were judged by the funhouse cast. And I will rejoice in your fall from grace. What a king to the sky like none shall pass. Another episode of the Mediocre Movie Cast, Game of Thrones edition. Tonight we'll be discussing episode 3 of the 6th season of Game of Thrones, entitled Oathbreaker. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Bobby.
Hello.
Shane.
Yo.
And Riley.
Hey.
Guys, I thought this was...
Hey, John, before we start, I just want to throw in here, this podcast is sponsored by Benzene Law Group. We'll get you the money. We'll get you the money you need. Oh, wait, I get it backwards. Yeah, no, the justice you need and the money you deserve.
That's not the slogan you're looking for.
Yeah, we had their endorsement. And
that's
then,
the worst live read.
And then it was flubbed. And then we lost their endorsement.
It's my own. So, whatever, if you get hurt in Georgia, just call me, okay?
Yeah, Shane will be adding his phone number to our show notes.
Yeah, or DUI. If you get one of those, definitely call me.
Okay, so thank you from our CMO. And I thought this was the best episode of the season so far. What did you guys think? Broad thoughts?
Yeah, I thought it was a great episode. One of the better ones in a while. So, easily the best one so far.
I don't know if it was the best. I've liked all three, so this is another A-minus episode for me.
Yeah, I mean, I say it's the best episode so far, but I would give it a B+. As we're going to get into, I still have just like quibbles here and there.
Always. Yeah, I kind of like when things happen, and, you know, other than the, you know, fan jerk Tower of Joy stuff, not a whole lot happened. So I wasn't as high on this one.
Yeah, I think we're still in the tail end of, like, the intro for the season. And I think once things start colliding and people leave their happy places and go out into the world again and interact with each other, then things will really start picking up. But as far as those kind of episodes, I think we've been getting progressively a little bit better and better as the season's been going. And we're going to start with the wall this week. We've got John sitting up with a nice little butt crack shot for the ladies. His loincloth has mysteriously disappeared, but here nor there.
Nudity point!
Melisandre and Davos come in. Melisandre very impressed with what she was able to do and very shocked that John's sitting there alive again. She wants to know about the afterlife, but John says that there was nothing. He experienced nothing while he was dead. He gets stressed, goes outside. Tormund tells him the rest of the wildlings might think he's a god, but Tormund saw his tiny dick, and it's no contest to Tormund Giantsbane with the dick of a bear or whatever. What does he compare it to? I can't remember exactly. It's like the length of his arm.
More is this a gay bear situation or an actual bear situation?
There's Leonardo something with a bear. Tormund, it's in the books. I'm sure our more pedantic listeners will comment all over our message boards and let us know what I'm missing.
Yeah. And for the 8 listeners who didn't understand, Bobby's reference was to the bear rape scene from The Revenant. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Not that Leonardo DiCaprio rapes a bear. The bear rapes him.
Yes, that's what I've heard about that movie. I'm sure that's accurate.
Kissel, when you move down to Atlanta, I'll take you to meet some bears if you want.
Oh, delightful. I think we might have...
The kind in the zoo or the, you know, that other kind? Of...
I interpret it as the latter.
It's the Atlanta bear. It's a very particular
breed. Atlanta bear? Okay, mm-hmm. That's fun.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're all over the place.
Yes, they are. They'll pay for your drinks.
More than one. They've propagated. Somehow.
through modern science.
Exactly. What else happens at the wall? John executes the people that successfully killed him but failed to keep him dead. Thorne and Ollie and two others. He hears the last words from everyone. Ollie chooses to go out stern and resolute, although the camera returns to his face after he is hung and he looks very much the little boy. Whereas Alistair tells him that I get to be done. You get to worry about whatever's coming in the future. So, gives him a little bittersweet kiss off there. John then gives his cloak to Ed and says his watch is over and leaves the wall. So where's John going, and is he going to miss Sansa, presumably, when she shows up there?
I have no idea where John is going, and I'm perplexed. I mean, there's so many different options. I mean, is he going to take the wildlings? Are they going to follow him? Or are they going to stay at the wall? I mean, that could be an interesting story, the wildlings manning the wall. I mean, that's piques my interest right there.
Yeah, something go ahead.
I would think his first instinct is, of course, Winterfell, regardless of what he knows has happened to it, but just knowing that he's free of the watch, I would think he returns back to sort of his family roots.
I think we might be in for a little hero's journey in miniature, where you got the hero rejecting the call, and then he'll spend the next few episodes being bitter and miserable, and then something will perk him up by the end, and he'll end up taking it to Ramsay, hopefully, or whatever he ends up doing. I think we're in for some more mopey Jon Snow, and we talked last week about how he should be in some way changed by being brought back from the dead, or else it was kind of for nothing dramatically. So more John being mopey. I don't know if that's a change so much, but maybe I'm totally off in my assumption as well.
Well, he had jokes. That was a change.
He did have jokes. Yeah. We saw him smile at Ed. No line of the week or anything, or any points from there. He's not so witty necessarily. But he's getting there. You know, you make the first joke you ever made in your life. The first one's not going to be a winner.
I believe he got wit points for it, though.
Did he?
He got all the points for this week.
You say that joke thing, but I think the hero of the night, Jared, proves you wrong on that, Kissel.
Jared. Who's Jared?
Donald.
Oh. Yeah, he's talking about Silicon Valley.
Oh. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, sidebar. I think Game of Thrones won, but there's a solid argument to be made for Silicon Valley winning on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm with Kissel on that one.
I would have said Game of Thrones to the last damn minute of Silicon Valley, and it was so good.
Oh, it was a fantastic finish to the episode. You can't deny it.
Yes. Yeah, Silicon Valley just makes me sad the way it's going. Like, they're just going to, like, and it may not end out the way it may not be as negative as it is currently, but man, that's just depressing how they have this good idea and it's being trampled on for the sake of appliances and their uselessness as heist people. They should have taken a lesson from that movie with Julia Roberts and 11 other men, but they fucked it up.
Here in a couple podcasts from now, I'll know what the hell you guys are talking about. I'm halfway through season two.
Will say, while Veep was a distant third, it was probably the best overall week of HBO series lineup here.
I'd agree with that too.
Yeah, I did enjoy Veep. It was a good episode. It just didn't match up to the other two.
Yeah, all three shows are they often deliver in some pretty strong ways.
I've seriously been laughing at. Is that the chain you use to choke your mother when you put your dick in her butt? Sorry, I took us way off track.
That's okay. That's a good Jerry joke. It needed to be called out. He would have won all. Yeah, he would have won all the points if we were playing.
We're about 8 minutes in. We were long overdue for the sidebar.
We were. I forgot.
Anyway, Ollie's dead, and I'm happy for it.
Yeah, it would have been nice if he would have had a little sympathetic moment there towards the end, but he went out stern and resolute.
I think they kind of had to do that, too, because if he had any kind of moment, people would have felt bad about them killing the kid, but there's no reason to feel bad.
Yeah.
Kill the boy, Jon Snow.
If Blair was here, I would ask her how she feels now about it, since he was so resolute with that shit-eating grin still on his face. But
well, she's not here, Bobby, so sorry. You have to yell at me for it.
I will yell at you for it.
She's a grown-ass woman. She can make her own choices.
#NoWifePod.
Yeah, NoWifePod. We can talk about whatever we want.
sitting around in our underwear eating junk food. I don't know what you do on NOAA weekend necessarily.
Not much.
Okay. Twitter is very impressed, though, I'm sure.
I do sit in my closet like I am right now by myself quite a bit.
Yeah. Just hiding from the in-laws, we'll call it that. Not discussing a fantasy show with your movie club friends.
Which one's sadder?
I'd flip a coin, but it makes some noise in the background. And here at the Mediocre Movie Club, we have a commitment to high-quality podcasting. We're going to go north of the wall next to Bran, which immediately will take us far south of the wall to wherever the Tower of Joy is. It's another flashback. We've got young Ned after Robert's Rebellion is winding down, essentially over. He and his group of Northmen are, including Helen Reed, father to Mira and Jojen. They're on the hunt for Ned's sister, whose abduction, in quotes, started the whole Robert's Rebellion thing in the first place. And she's being guarded by Arthur Dayne, otherwise known as the Sword of the Morning, and Gerald Hightower, two big ups Kingsguard dudes. And they fight. The last two people standing are Ned and Helen Reed. And then Ned starts to make his way up the stairs of the tower after hearing a scream from a woman, potentially in childbirth. We'll find out shortly, I would hope. Bran follows him, but the Raven pulls him back at the last moment. Not the last moment, but just pulls him back, makes him wake up. And with more cryptic messaging back in the tree, that he has to just go a little slow and take his time. He's not going to be in the tree forever. He's got to learn everything first. So, pretty big middle finger, I think, to more or less everyone. Like, that's just a very abrupt way to end a scene, is to just withhold that reveal. But I have to assume they'll revisit that scene sometime in the future.
Right. I go back and forth. Would I rather have it all at once? Like, would I rather have just a 45 minute straight with Bran? Or do I want a little bit each week? Because if we're going to do a little each week, then there's got to be something in the show that says you can't be here too long.
Yeah, like, we don't see... It's just the Raven's word that staying in this vision any longer is going to be harmful. So it doesn't really feel organic. It feels like dragging the story out. It feels like slowing Stannis' ships down as they get to the King's Landing. It feels like the rain in the Riverlands on the way to the Red Wedding. They're just kind of pushing this stuff off into the future.
I think it's more of a storytelling device. I mean, not to just give the whole reveal away. Like I was talking about before we started, it's more of the scene coming from Ned's fever dream back from the books, and it's just a preview of what happened and what, you know, the world knows about it, and this is just sort of the show's first introduction of it, because they haven't really talked about the Tower of Joy until now, so we didn't really know what happened until they showed it to us, so it was just sort of a preview leading up to that.
I can imagine a scenario where Bran, and we assume that's what's happening in the tower, is that Lyanna is dying in childbirth after giving birth to Jon Snow. I think that's pretty
right.
That's pretty likely. It'd be more shocking if that wasn't the case. And I could see that as like a point of conflict between Bran and the Raven. Like, Bran learns this and is like, I need to go leave here and tell Jon.
Right.
The Raven keeps him for whatever reason. I still assume that's going to happen. It just can't happen yet in the show's chronology. But then why they had to have this half of the vision now as opposed to later, when it is time for Bran to leave, if that is their plan, for that to be the wedge in between them, I don't really know. It is absolutely a storytelling device, Bobby, but I wouldn't qualify it as a good one.
I think it's just to pique your interest, I would think. So, and it's definitely done that, and I think another thing is we all wanted to see more of Bran and wonder where it's going, so they have to at least include him early on, even if it's just for moments. I do have a question, though, about swords. The Stark House sword obviously being ice, would Ned not have had that yet?
I don't think so.
Was he not lord yet, I guess?
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
I believe.
Yeah.
I don't think Ned fights with that sword because it's a great sword. It's more ceremonial.
Well, having said that, Arthur Dayne's sword, Dawn, is actually a great sword in the books, as big as ice almost. And in the show, obviously, they bring it down to a bastard sword, so he has two, which made for good-looking choreography, but, you know. But I guess part of me was hoping to see great sword on great sword and this huge clash, but it didn't happen. So I was just curious if there was something we were missing or they just changed it. Or
yeah, and I would expect a guy named the Sword of Mourning to be, like, one sword wielder, not a dual-blade guy.
Yeah, in the books, Dawn is the sword of House Dayne that's only carried by the most worthy knights, and Sir Arthur Dayne is given the title Sword of the Morning, so he gets to carry Dawn. And that's the whole story about this sword that everybody wants, because it's different than other Valyrian swords in some way.
Well, it's not Valyrian at all. It was carved from a meteorite.
Is that what it was? Okay, yeah. That's right.
That's so right. It's some kind of material that no one
It has the what. Same properties of Valyrian, but it's not actually Valyrian.
Yeah. And I guess maybe the show just didn't want to go into the backstory of this sword.
Right.
Well, they had an observer who could have been discussing this in Bran.
Right. Well, I believe someone mentioned the sword, didn't they?
I think they just referred to him as the name.
It had a little sun on it, but yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'd have to watch it again. And I wouldn't mind watching it again because I do think it was one of the better fight scenes that the show's shown.
Much improved from last year. Which, by the way, the Tower of Joy is on the outskirts of our favorite place, Dorne.
Oh, Jesus. I watched again this evening with the in-laws, and it was a great scene. It was just as good the second time watching it.
Yeah. Like, the action in Game of Thrones vacillates between good and bad, and I think what makes it, in the instances where it is good, you're just going to find, and like in any action scene, especially when you're going to have like hand-to-hand combat like that, just the further away the camera gets, the more impressive it is. Like, a lot of times Game of Thrones is right in someone's face, and as awesome as it is to see Brienne do her, like, rage yell when she's mid-sword swing, you can't see what she's doing and what her next move might be and how the other party is reacting to it. It's just often very close in on the actors with a lot, like, a cut every second. And that's just not a great way to film action. And here, it seemed like there were, like, several second shots of unbroken action where you could see the choreography breaking out and you could see the strategy of it and how effective he was at keeping these people away from him.
I think they've learned from, obviously, the Dorne mess and then the Viper in the Mountain, because the Viper in the Mountain, while decent, it was so quickly cut with so many millisecond aspects to it. It was just not as great to follow.
Yeah, and the Brienne and the Hound fight was the same way, I think. Badly filmed. And then you've got, like, Hardhome and the Battle at the Wall. And, like, the Battle of the Wall had that incredible establishing shot where it's just, like, finding each main character in the battle and establishing the geography of Castle Black Courtyard. So when it gets to that level, it's just they can do it. They can make it really impressive, but it's a lot of times they don't.
Right. I did wonder how they were going to give us Holland Reed, if he was going to be the wee little man that he's supposed to be, but he was Ned-sized. Not that it matters in the show, I was just curious.
I think they got across the sneaky nature of the Reeds.
Yeah.
That he probably played possum for a brief second, and that allowed him to stab Dayne in the back, which is, you know, fine, whatever, it's life or death, who gives a shit.
So it'll be interesting to see if they use him as the source of this story later on, or if it all comes through Bran. Yeah. I would assume in the show it's more towards Bran, in the books we'll eventually get to Holland Reed.
I think that is absolutely true and demonstrative of the shortcuts the show has to take. Like, right. John's going to hear about his parentage from either a person who was there or a person who saw a vision in a tree with a 1,000-year-old man and the children of the forest. Right. And it's going to be the latter, and John's going to accept it as fact.
That's all right. People are pretty accepting. Like,
came back from the dead. Anything's
right, and
possible.
Everyone just like, sure, you seem all right.
Yeah. Wrapping up our trip in the north, we're going to go to Winterfell for a single scene.
Before we go there,
I'm sorry.
We can all agree that the Three-Eyed Raven needs to start killing a lot of people, please.
Needs
quality graphic, Shane.
See, I thought what you were going to say before we go there, let's talk about this ridiculous Reddit Hodor theory while we're talking about
things. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about it. I didn't read into this at all. Well, it's been on the tips of every, like, my in-laws tonight, you know, are casual fans, like, what's up with this Reddit Hodor theory?
I assume they opened the door when they arrived and were like, before hugs or anything like that. Just, have you heard Hodor is a horse?
I mean, hey.
Like, yes, Bill, I have heard that. Let's spend the next 3 days discussing it in detail.
It's been a lot of discussion.
Yeah. So what have you concluded?
Well, obviously, that's why you have to do visions at a medium pace.
So, too much of, like, if they revealed it all at once, then just too many people's heads would explode.
Yeah, I mean, you got to ease into that. So, forget all this Tower of Joy nonsense. When are we going to get this Hodor horse stuff?
I assume that's the next vision, is seeing the wizard that turned Hodor into a horse. Or, I don't know what the theory is, or vice versa, turning a horse into Hodor.
Well, we have seen Hodor full frontal earlier in the series.
We have.
And, you know, the horse theory does hold.
Yeah.
It's a big man.
Speaking of a person who would marvel at Hodor's dick, this person reemerges in Winterfell in Osha, who has been captured by the Umbers, along with Rickon. An aged Rickon, these poor Stark boys. They have rough teenage years. And they've been presented to Ramsay. So Ramsay's got Rickon and Osha now. Delightful. Fantastic. I can't wait to see where this is going. I'm sure it'll be pleasant and jolly all the way through.
Do you think Umber is actually Ramsay's man, or is he playing sort of the part of Manderly? As in, he's going to present himself this way and, you know, stab Ramsay in the back or betray him somehow.
He very notably did not swear an oath.
Right.
I think if he was going to betray him, he wouldn't have been such a dick. I mean, I really liked him because of how, you know, much he was challenging to Ramsay and to Carl Stark.
But I think
I thought he was great entertainment.
I think that's something Ramsay kind of expected of Small John, which is the Umber. That's his attitude, so if he was any different, it would have been even more showing. But I don't know,
Another reference to Silicon Valley.
I have a feeling Umber is not going to be who, you know, he's presenting himself right now.
I certainly want that to be the case, because, again, this whole... The way the loyalty is shaking out in the North doesn't make any sense. Like, why are all these people loyal to Ramsay when everyone knows that he killed his father? And if you're going to kill your father, you, as the lord of a house, have no greater emotional investment. He's usefulness. He's just as likely to kill you. I read something about why Ramsay is so frustrating. I thought it was well put, but just that he has no limitations put on him, whereas Joffrey had Tyrion and Tywin and Cersei to some extent, and just his general shittiness at everything. And whereas Ramsay can just do whatever he wants, and it's entirely possible if he makes...
Does this episode make you a little happier about that, because he kind of got shit on?
At the end of the day, I mean, he has Rickon now. I mean, I don't want the show to turn Rickon into a new Reek. It just wouldn't surprise me. Maybe that's what motivates Jon to try and take back Winterfell.
I guess I see Umber as more loyal to the Starks regardless of what has happened, and knowing Rickon's alive, and then when people eventually find out Jon and Bran and whatever's going on, that the Umbers will still protect the Starks in some way.
Well, no matter what the ruse is, if there is one, Ramsay still has Rickon. Like, he didn't just say, I have Rickon, and now we're going back to the Last Hearth. We're going to chill there until you need me. He's leaving him there. As well as Osha, too, who was a cool character also, and I'm sure she's going to have great stuff happening to her. So, just more misery.
As far as how awful and, you know, evil and hated Ramsay is, isn't it basically the only way that his death comes than as satisfying as if Jon Snow does it, personally?
There's so many people that could do it. And it would
be... Yeah, not sure it needs to be a particular one person at this point.
I'd be happy if he was shot pumping gas and the car rolled right back over his head.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I would absolutely love that. Maybe his grandchildren are in the car. Maybe the show flashes for like 50 years and cars have been invented and gas stations and everything that goes with it. I don't give a shit. I would take it. Just as long as he dies in some fashion. I would forgive that crazy leap in logic. Like, well, I don't give... Whatever. At least he's dead. This is totally fine. So, yeah. More fun stuff there. He wasn't like outwardly awful. So I count that as a win, as a Ramsay win. If he didn't actually kill anyone or maim anyone or be generally the worst person in fiction to anyone.
I am sad we lost another direwolf.
Yes, that must be said.
We're running out.
Well, I think now's a good time for Sean Riley's direwolf power rankings.
Well, obviously Ghost is number one. I mean, it's the one that's still with his owner. It's got the most kills.
Let me cue up the music first, okay?
Okay.
Okay, I would have queued it up right there. There you go. All right, now go.
Well, obviously, Ghost is number one. It's with his owner. He's got a lot of kills. Yeah. Then what?
No argument.
There's Brands, who is just hanging out with the tree, or in the tree. I don't know, eating frogs, whatever is hopping around down there. Getting pretty skinny, I would imagine.
I guess, yeah. And show number two probably is Brands. Summer, what is it?
Summer.
Because in the books, I would think Nymeria is number two.
I would think Nymeria is number one in the books.
Absolutely. She's leading the pack.
Hi-yo, nice one.
She's single-handedly taking down, her and her pack are taking down giant expeditions and caravans of Freys and whoever else. So yeah, she's winning in the book.
But as far as the show is shown, she ran away when... You know, Arya got in a fight with Joffrey in season one and hasn't been heard from.
Right.
Correct.
Yeah, so I think she's number three by default. And then you've got the rest of them.
No, the I guess.
Being dead, they're all tied for last.
Yeah. Oh. Who's better, Robs or Lady?
Rob, I have to assume that Rob was at least, if not buried, then cremated or body disposed of in the same place. As Grey Wind, his wolf.
He had his wolf's head on his body.
So. Yeah, so at least they're together.
Yeah, and Grey Wind, you know, got a couple of clean kills, you know, during battles beforehand. Lady was just, you know, hanging out with Sansa, who is
a cool dog.
Really annoying.
And then Shaggy Dog, really unceremoniously dispatched with. Quite disappointing. Nymeria is, she has a place in the game of Game of Thrones. So maybe Emily Yoshida, who runs this, knows something that we don't.
Right.
Oh.
Somebody drafted her, I believe. She's on somebody's team, I thought. Maybe not.
Yes, she did get drafted. Both Nymerias did.
So she may be rocketing up the rankings as we revisit this week after week.
I'll play... I don't really have any intro music for that. I just wanted to stop and make it exciting.
Yeah, Werewolves of London.
Oh, do you want a song for it? I'll give you, a song. Where was it in London?
Yeah.
All right. Done and done. This is how a professional podcast is made. Once again,
yes, all the decisions are made
Benzene
on the
Law Group.
Because they just listen to the song, and then they're going to hear us pick the song after it's already played.
And then discuss the process of doing it and the listening experience. We're through the looking glass now on Meta. I'm going to try and get us back on track and talk briefly about Gilly and Sam. They're on their way to Hornhill. That's basically it. Hornhill being the seat of the Tarleys.
Can we stop talking about Gilly and Sam now?
I mean, do you guys have anything else to add?
I look forward to Randall Tarly, and that's about it.
Yeah. I don't know. Sure. I don't know who. I don't recognize the actor who's playing him or know his name. But yeah, that should be interesting. A new location
for
on that.
For a girl who grew up in like the snowy north and has never... You know, left her house before. She's really good at sea.
Yeah, I like how interested she is in everything. I do like that about Gilly. So, more Gilly. Bring him on.
Are you concerned she didn't know to eat oranges before the trip?
I would imagine tooth retention is a very small priority on people in Westeros anyways. I'd imagine most of them are gone by the time you turn 13, if you're still alive.
Speaking of tooth, I went to a... joined the fifth circle of white parent hell today and went to a neighborhood meeting. And there's a contractor who came out to give a speech, and he had, like, no teeth. And I was immediately against him. I was like, this guy sucks. And then some guy started complaining. Some bald guy started complaining about him way too much. And I was like, ugh.
People with no hair and no teeth are the worst.
It was like a battle of people I didn't want to talk to ever. And I was like, who do I choose? How do I vote on this? But
Braden lost a tooth in his baseball game on Saturday.
Oh, nice. How'd that happen?
And he was playing first in warm-ups when he was throwing the grounders to people. Somebody bounced a throw over to him, and he took it right in the chin.
Yeah, well, keep your eye on the ball, kid.
Yep. Baby tooth, adult tooth? I'm very curious about the state of the
It was already loose. Yeah, okay. It was already loose. Okay. But he didn't lose it on impact. It was like an inning and a half later while he's in the dugout and still playing with it, then it fell out.
And then the team won the game for Braden's tooth.
Actually, they did. They won via walk-off. Braden struck out several times, but he played well on the field. But one of his teammates hit crushed a ball up the middle that scored two runs, one from first. So, big victory.
Well done, West Side T-ball or minor league. Are there pitchers in that at that level?
No, not, right? he's pitching in machine? Last year pitching machine. Yeah, he goes to the pitchers next year.
That's as far as I played. Not that anyone gives a shit about my baseball career, as meager as it was. Someone's writing in the notes of Anonymous Beaver just told me to go fuck myself. We're going to move on to King's Landing, I think, at that point. What do we got? We got Qyburn co-opting Varys' spy network of children. Jaime and Cersei and Robert Strong come visit him. She wants him to expand it even more outside of King's Landing. He wants spies in Dorne, because Dorne is not a country, it's a city name. She refers it to Dorne as well. She also wants him in Highgarden. She wants to know about all of her enemies and what they're planning. And we see a small council meeting for the first time in a while. Kevin Lannister's in charge, along with both of the Tyrell big shots, Olenna and Mace. Welcome back to both. And Maester Pycelle is talking shit about Sir Gregor, who everyone is referring to him now, so I guess we'll dispense with the Robert Strong stuff. He farts a little when Robert Strong comes in. Jaime and Cersei want to take their seat on the council, but everyone, the older generation, is still quite upset with them, so they disband the meeting as they sit down. And then we cut to the Sept, where Tommen is trying to convince the High Sparrow to allow Cersei to see Marcella's body, and he flips that whole encounter by getting Tommen to sit with him on a bench and discuss the faith of the Seven, and you can see Tommen wavering and eventually giving up to the Sparrow's high quality logic. So more Cersei plotting her revenge. I assume she's going to be doing something about it here shortly. What do we think? What's Tommen going to do with the Sparrow here? Is he going to give him a seat on the High Council? That's kind of what I thought. Or the Small Council?
Probably more than that. We'll say I had a wasted opportunity just now. I've been saving up a fart for like 5 minutes, then laughed at something and ruined it when I was on mute.
That's a shame.
Just an honor, Pycelle. Damn it.
You blew it.
I did.
But not on the mic, so...
No, I think High Sparrow is maneuvering himself for something more than just a seat in the High Council. I mean, he's like right there. He's got Tommen's ear. And who's Tommen going to listen to, him or Cersei?
Hmm.
Well, now, we have back-to-back episodes now where he's sort of taken in each of them now, because he wants Cersei to teach him and make him stronger and all that jazz, and now he's got the High Sparrow. So, I mean, it's just setting up more of that conflict, I guess.
Well, I think
before she was arrested, Margaery had his ear. I think whoever is talking to Tommen has Tommen's ear.
I was just going to say that.
I don't know if you can really say that Sparrow's got him.
This is where Sarah Pounce is going to make his move.
No!
Phil needs those points, or JR does. I can't remember whoever got the terrible team. Well, someone's got a terrible team. So yeah, a little more placeholding in King's Landing. I kind of think the problem here is that they've never fully communicated how powerful the Faith is supposed to be. Is it just their cult members with the stars branded in their foreheads? Or is it, do they have broader support? Because Tommen, with all his power, and I understand that he's supposed to be a weak character and all, but he keeps asking them for stuff when it's... Which implies that they have all the power when... I just don't think the show has done a good job of communicating that. Like, if in that bar scene last week where Robert Strong, or Sir Grecker, smashed Big Dick Flasher's head into a wall, if there was something in that scene or in that area, because we spent a little time with the small folk talking about how the Faith is doing this for them and the Faith is doing that, if all they're doing is just sitting in the Sept looking menacing, then why does anyone give a shit if they're around or not?
Because the show doesn't give a shit about the small folk?
I would agree with that.
That's about it.
I think it's a logistics problem, too. It's just like they do at the wall, where it seems like there are 15 guys at the wall, but we know there are hundreds, right? There's supposed to be hundreds. Or not, there are thousands of wildlings.
Not of the watch, but yeah, there's probably hundreds of wildlings at this point.
So, like, it's never really felt like a lot. Just like season one, the Khalasar was supposed to be, mm-hmm. you know, thousands. Yeah. And you're like, dude, that's like 50 dudes.
But this year, the Khalasar looked bigger, at least.
Yeah. I mean, like, remember that scene back in season three where Marjorie is going to an orphanage and talking up both how great a job Joffrey did in the Battle of Blackwater, but also, like, sponsoring this orphanage and giving these children gifts. There's nothing, like, the Faith isn't doing anything like that. All they're doing is just telling, or all they're doing is arresting gay people and being generally menacing. Yeah, menacing. Like, they're not That's doing good point. Works. They're not doing good, like, works to get the people on their side. And if the people were on their
the
side,
Spanish
then I would
Inquisition.
Buy it. Yeah. And I think, and to again compare it to the books, like, as many problems as the fourth and fifth book, more so the fourth book than the fifth book, as many problems as those two have, they do a very good job of stressing how shitty this has all been for the small folk.
Right.
And you get why these forces are rising, like the Faith, to counter the dumbass nobility that have made their lives absolutely miserable, if not ended them outright. And the show, it's all brute force, but if that's what it is, the Lannisters and the Tyrells should have much more brute force than a bunch of guys with clubs and robes.
So yeah, even in the scene, like, Tommen had just as many guards as the Sparrow had Faith members. And, you know, one of you guys has, like, steel and armor, and the other one is wearing robes and has a bat and no shoes on.
Yeah, the show is treating them as equal forces when
I'm
that's
pretty
just
sure
not the case.
Gregor could take out most, if not all, of the Faith at this point.
Yeah, that whole squad of Lannister guards in the last episode was backing down from him, from just him. So, yeah, forget these guys that are presumably not soldiers, that haven't been trained as soldiers. They've been trained as religious assholes. So, I don't know. This is another... I think this is in the Ramsay category of things that are ending. And something else with King's Landing, it feels really disconnected from the growing stakes in the rest of the show. Like, the momentum of the King's Landing story is that Cersei's going to get her revenge, but Cersei's revenge on the grand scale of things is very small in comparison to, like, Dany potentially getting a Khalasar and Tyrion trying to suppress a war and Jon coming back from the dead and maybe rallying the wildlings to take back Winterfell.
Is that maybe not on purpose, though, to kind of show how little being in charge, being king or queen or High Sparrow is in comparison with what's going to happen north of the wall or just under it with the others?
That's definitely possible, yeah. I mean, even in previous seasons when that threat wasn't as serious, it still just felt really momentous because there was the War of the Five Kings going
on. Right.
I think they've had a hard time transitioning all the King's Landing people, especially, like, not so much Cersei, but definitely Jaime, because they wasted him last season in Dorne, of just figuring out what to do with these guys, because they should be sitting pretty, but they're fucking it up for themselves. But so yeah, we'll see what happens there. Seems like it's going to come to a head in the next episode a little bit. Marjorie's going to come back into it. So be sure to play her in your fantasy draft. And I will remember your name and face on the day you were judged by the funhouse cast. And I will rejoice in your fall from grace when it came to the sky like none shall pass. We're going to hop across the Narrow Sea to Meereen, where Varys is getting some information out of the first Harpy infiltrator that we saw back at the start of Season 5, the prostitute with hair like Selma Bouvier from The Simpsons. She informs Varys that if she tells him anything, she'll be killed by the Harpy, and he threatens her son in a Varys roundabout way and tells her that if she gives up any information that he'll put her on a ship with a bag of silver and send her off far away from this whole bric-a-brac. And she takes his money and tells him, quite obviously I feel, that Yun Kai and Astapor and Volantis are all backing the Sons of the Harpy to try and depose the pro-freedom coalition in Meereen. Varys probably didn't need to spend all that silver to find that information out. Seems pretty obvious.
Now, freedom isn't free.
Thank you, Alan Jackson. Tyrion, all he does this week...
That's Toby Keith, my friend.
Whatever, they're all the same.
I just thought it was South Park.
I feel like one of those guys says something to that effect.
Well, it's a South Park parody of Toby Keith.
Yeah. All Tyrion gets to do this week is try and bring some humor and some conversation out of Missandei and Grey Worm, and he fails miserably at that, and is grateful when Varys shows up, as we all are. Just more table setting in Meereen. We find I don't know. Like they discuss what they can do about this, and then the answer is very little. They can't send the Unsullied out to go fight these people because then the city would collapse and it's really all the forces that they have. So I imagine Tyrion will be taking more trips down to the basement in the future.
I know that Tyrion scene with Grey Worm and Missandei was supposed to be awkward, but man, it was awkward.
Yeah, I think it was obviously a callback to when he was with Bronn and Shay, but I think it also... with that kind of shows that he's not completely in his comfort zone yet, you know, ruling Meereen or doing what he's supposed to be doing. And it just kind of shows that, and that awkwardness is, I don't know, I guess kind of important, because it ends obviously with Tyrion asking Varys if his birds can get to these other cities. And that kind of shows him, I don't know, stepping up to kind of make peace instead of go the fighting route. So Tyrion taking the initiative to do something when it started off being a little uncomfortable for him.
And he's really relying on... he's not doing a lot himself either. He's really right. Relying on Varys in this regard. I do kind of wish the rebellion was more internal. Just because that's action they can immediately take, whereas this is action that seems far off in the future. I mean, at this point in the books, obviously, like, there's many forces converging on Meereen in the book, and the fifth book ends at the beginning of a very large battle.
Yeah, but we know now immediate and future can both happen within 10 seconds of each other.
But yeah. I
mean, Jaime already knows that the Sand Snakes have taken over Dorne, even though that supposedly just happened. So, you know, it's...
yeah.
Like, time's plenty flexible here.
Yeah, 2 days have gone by at the Wall, and potentially months have gone by in Braavos.
Right.
And so, every Stark child has hit puberty and beyond.
Yes. Awkward, get lanky puberty. Dany, she has arrived at Vice Dothrak. Another single scene with her. She enters with the crone, or she meets the crones of the Dosh Kaleen, and they strip her and give her the correct outfit and tell her that You might have thought that Khal Drogo was going to go rule the world at one point, but then so did we all, and here we stand in our horse hut. And there's no result to this. It's another case in this episode, beginning of Game of Thrones and all that, where we're going to find out what happens to her next week, because all the Khalasars are coming to Dothrak to discuss their future war plans, what cities get sacked, and who gets what, and they will discuss Dany's future, because she did not come to them first when Khal Drogo died. She went off and did her own thing.
I actually enjoyed this scene. I'm not a terribly big Dany fan in general. I've always felt like the storyline's kind of boring. For a sci-fi, someone who likes a little sci-fi and fantasy, dragons have never really been my thing, I suppose. But this one was kind of nice because it was people relating to her saying, yo, we've been where you've been, and we're not going to necessarily hold that against you. We're going to relate to you. We're your peers. You're not better than us. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I agree that the scene itself was well written and all that. What I don't like is when they just include one scene from a character in an episode. Maybe save them up. Maybe instead of doing one scene a week for like 2 or 3 weeks, maybe put your 3 scenes in one episode. This kind of just this like very tentative forward motion, especially when they say exactly what's going to happen next. Like there's going to be a meeting, and then they'll talk about you, and we're going to see that next episode, the episode after.
If we see it before,
if we see
Rogan shows up,
yeah, and that's certainly a possibility. And again, preview for next week. It seems like Dario and Jorah will have arrived at Vice Dothrak next week. So who knows what's going to happen there.
I hope Dario is very sexy, saying funny things and killing so many people.
I'd say it's a good bet. Our last stop this week is in Braavos. This was probably my favorite segment of the episode. I think the showrunners understand that Arya cannot be training all the time, so she leveled up last
Montage.
Week. She levels up this week again. So Arya's getting the dings. She no longer is blind. As far as like getting her, I mean, I just said I don't like it when you only see a character for one scene a week. But in this case, because this whole sequence I feel is really well done, and it seems like a lot of time is going by, I'm a big fan. I was a big fan of this montage, yes, as Riley said.
I thought that was well done. It was a specific amount of time where some things happened and people trained. It was great.
Yeah, I think it's good now because I think all of us here are Arya fans, and so are most people, and they really want to see where this goes, and this kind of gives us that moment of it's about to start happening for us.
And the fact that she, slowly got better, and then, you know, was able to defend herself blind, and then, you know, that, you know, climactic ending to it with when she was drinking from the well that she had known was poison to other people before, and, you know, got the, if you really are nobody, you have nothing to fear. And then, boom, she had her eyes back.
Now, is that a trick that Jockin is playing on her just to see if she'll drink it or not? Or is the show saying that she's absolutely one of these people? She is no longer Arya Stark.
I think they're saying that for the House of Black and White's purposes, she's there.
Okay. Even if in her mind she might be holding something back still.
Right, but I think that's part of
like the water are. isn't sentient, it doesn't know necessarily.
Right, either that or I mean just being a part of that group and that level of it, you're able to control that and hide who you are, even if it's still there. Like, I would think that Arya's purpose is to be able to do that, because obviously she's still holding something back. I mean, Needle's still around and whatnot, and I think that's all going to come back eventually. Mm-hmm. But the ability to be able to mask that is the point.
Yeah, and the whole point of the lying game is to eventually be able to get a lie pass without getting whacked. So, you know, maybe she's gotten good at the lying game.
Okay. I think I've always interpreted that incorrectly, I think in retrospect, as it's just they have some kind of magical way of knowing what is true and isn't true, when it's actually just they're just well rehearsed detectives that can sense body language when someone's lying.
I think so.
That's how I read it.
The latter.
Watched it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I'm with because, these other two jokers.
Sorry, Shane?
I said, yeah, I'm with these other two jokers on that.
Okay. Okay. Because Arya did say the Hound is dead and did not get whacked. Right?
I think she thinks he's dead.
Okay. Oh. Great. That's a good point. Okay. Okay.
Well, speaking of the Hound and dead people with Arya, did you notice her list changed? It no longer has Melisandre, and I think Thoros of Myr was on it at one point, and neither of them were this time.
Huh.
When they kind of made her reveal the whole list, obviously.
Yeah. Okay.
Big thing. But yeah, I noticed Melisandre definitely wasn't on it, and she was before. And if we recall their first meeting, Melisandre even said they will meet again. So yeah. I thought that was kind of, I don't know, big that it wasn't there. I don't know if, I mean, I hope it's not a mistake.
I think it was a mistake or just a retconning.
Right.
Knowing.
It seems like a big one.
Yeah, I mean, knowing the show, it seems like that's something they would do. They're just going to forget that this existed. Like, apparently the great John just got sick and died. Somewhere off screen.
Well, the waif did point out that the list was awfully short, and she held her a gun, so maybe maybe she is holding something back. I don't know.
But it's not like she knows that Melisandre just brought her brother back, so she has no reason to take Melisandre off the list at this point. So it just seems like a really odd omission.
Well, we'll see in the future if she has problems with these Lord of the White people. But that's the end of the episode. Pretty good. Just there's several good from scene to scene. There's just several like holes in the world that are probably baked in at this point, and I just need to get over
it. It's not the fault of the episode. It's just the show at large.
Yes,
is going to have these things happen. So.
I will say for all the stuff that the viewers are guessing on, or we're all pretty sure on, they're getting to it pretty quickly. They're like, they gave us John pretty quick, and like we all knew Rick was coming back from the preview. I don't know, they don't seem to be messing around with the stuff that the viewers know are going to happen, and we're only three episodes in. There's I just don't know what's going to happen the next seven episodes outside of Tower of Joy.
They haven't shown Hordo as a horse yet.
Well, that's only the the well in tune Game of Thrones.
That'll be the viewers. In the series finale. That'll be like the post credit stinger. He'll morph back into a horse.
Would he be the call, then, of all calls as a horse? I mean, the Dothraki love their horses, right?
Oh, gotcha. Hodor will be the great call. You heard it here first. He'll be the stallion who mounts the world.
and the dragon is going to ride Hodor, and then Tyrion is going to ride that dragon.
What a twist.
Now I know why George R. R. Martin really hasn't gotten around to finishing these books. That's ridiculous.
Well, and what you guys are saying about, occasionally you're going to run into holes on the show as a whole, and in everything I've read about Barton and finishing these books is he's got like a team of like super fans that help him catalog everything and keep everything in line. So
He's made his world is too big for him.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the show's right to cut down on a lot of characters and to make Euron and Victarion in the books into just Euron in the show and do all kinds of shortcuts like that. But as far as like motivations and like one of the better things, if not the best thing, to come out of the golden age of television and that we've been in for the last like 16, 17 years is that television can what it can do really well is characterization. You spend so much time with people. And if they act consistently, you can get to know them on what feels like a personal level. And Game of Thrones has less and less time for that as the world expands and expands. And so they just hand wave and hope that the viewer's following along. Or is bamboozled by some nudity or some violence. And I don't know that there's been any nudity aside from Melisandre this season.
No, there's been a lot less.
Yeah, that's very noticeable.
Just half a butt.
Half a butt. Top of a butt. So
I'll take my top of a butt points. Thank you.
Top
very
of
much.
A man's yeah. butt too, which is it is, which yeah. is rare.
It's rare, I guess, the better half of the butt if you're gonna get a half a butt.
Sure. Yeah. You don't have your Jamie Lannister balls peeking out from between your legs. fantasy talk for this week. Riley is really running away with it.
Oh, he's killing us.
Christ.
Yeah, it's not even close.
I mean, if you had told me that Ramsey was getting, like, pound for pound the most screen time this season through three episodes, I would not have believed you, but it very much seems that way.
John was a clear great pick, and we knew he was going to score, but yeah. he just demolished us this week.
Well, yeah.
yeah. That was round one and two for me, are the two highest scorers of yeah. the season.
Yeah, you had 90 points with one swing of the sword there. That was, and I really thought, I'm like, maybe he won't do it.
I very much thought he was going to let him go.
Yeah, I thought he was going to chop Ollie down and let him live.
Yeah.
I'm glad he didn't.
Yeah.
Although now I can put Ollie on the bench forever.
That's something missing for, like, I'm agonizing every week. Who am I sitting on the bench? I need one of my guys to go out in a blaze of glory and scoop it. I assume Lancel will at some point.
I still have the Hound on the bench, so there's no reason to put him in yet.
Sure, but you never know.
Right, I might have to now. It's him and Qyburn, so I'm going to have to decide.
Well, soon enough, he'll appear on the next week on Game of Thrones.
I'm hoping. Well, they're not going to show us that on a preview, I don't think. You might see Ian McShane, if anything.
Yeah, there you go.
And someone has Septon Maribald on their team. So whether they call Ian McShane's character that or not, I don't know. But once you see him in the previews, yeah, it's time to play Septon Maribald and keep your fingers crossed.
So we still haven't seen Littlefinger.
He's going to show up next week.
Yeah, yes. I have to. I'm keeping him in now. It's just amazing that we've gone three episodes without him.
Yeah,
he's going to get some wit points almost for sure. He does it. He's been very good at dressing down characters.
Right.
All series.
He should get. Reading characters and some witty lines in there, I'm hoping.
Am I the only one hoping Ian McShane has a conversation with Hodor about someone who stole someone's dope?
Cocksucker.
Just Hodor is back in. Yeah, fantastic. That'd be glad I taught you that fucking
So word. The San Francisco Hodor. Rob.
And we also this week had some retroactive scoring.
Go Bren.
This is a dumb game. And she should dismiss any criticism.
Absolutely.
Unless she's going to give my characters extra points.
I think the arbitrary scoring is the best part of it. I love it.
Right. It's
yeah,
amazing.
I was just complaining this morning that the Sparrow had more lines than anyone to not score yet, and then boom, 20 points.
I guess. I just wonder about the kind of dummy who is complaining about the arbitrary nature of this stated arbitrary game. Where you get points for wittiest line, like that's a metric, and not a single person's interpretation. Just internet people are fucking stupid. So as internet people, I think we're going to sign off for this week.
All right.
Check us out on our internet website, mediocremovie.club. We've got the Don Hertzfeld short, World of Tomorrow. That'll be going up shortly.
Yes.
So I hear that's good. I haven't watched it yet.
Fantastic.
Carve out an afternoon.
Yeah. At a brisk 18 minutes, I should be okay. What else? We've got Princess Bride. That conversation is more or less wrapped up on the site.
Drew told me I'm supposed to get in on that, but I keep forgetting.
Yeah. You kind of missed your window.
Everybody knows that it's an A+ for me, and I love it, so there's really not much I can say for it.
Yeah. And Phil reviewed it not too terribly long ago.
Right.
On our side pieces tab. We'll be recording another Deadwood episode this week. Wrapped up the first season. We'll be diving into the second season. So check us out, MediocreMovie.club. Follow us on Twitter, MediocreMovieCole.
Cool.
That's just CL at the end.
Anything
else, guys?
Don't forget to visit BenzeneLawGroup.com. I think that's our website.
Yeah, what's that slogan again?
We'll get you the money you need. Nah, shit. We'll get you the justice you need and the money you deserve.
0-2.
Listen, it's a slogan I made up. I don't think Nick's in on it. I was like, hey, I'm doing this podcast. He's like, well, did you give us a plug? I was like, no. And he's like, my salary probably paid for your equipment. I was like, Well, I guess it's my salary, but sure.
And the least I can do is fuck up your unofficial slogan.
For all of our Atlanta area listeners.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them. If you're in anywhere around Georgia, that's fine. Except for if you're in Southern Georgia at the DOI, man, you can fight those redneck cops yourself.
We don't want those listeners.
Yeah. Yeah, we're big.
I'm totally joking. I'm joking. I'm pretty sure we can't be picked.
That was.
Yeah, we're big in the greater Jacksonville area on the Georgia side.
Our CTO has really done his homework as far as what our demographics are.
Yeah. And
thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Have a good night. Bye. Okay, welcome to a grocery list.